the river, flowing in my soul.
We know that belonging matters. Every educator has seen what happens when a learner feels seen, safe, and connected. And what happens when the learner doesn't? But Sarita Hammond asks us to press further. Belonging to what? Sarita is the author of Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain, and also of Rebuilding Students' Learning Power, Teaching for Instructional Equity and Cognitive Justice. In Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain, she showed that culture shapes how brain makes meaning and what students learn deeply when trusting relationships, psychological and intellectual safety, and meaningful challenge help move them from dependent to independent learning. Her work helps educators understand the deep connection between culture, cognition, equity, and academic learning. Sarita's central point in this conversation is that social belonging is essential, but not the final goal. Students need to belong to a community of learners. They need to experience the classroom as a place where they are invited into the craft of learning, where they learn how to think, how to talk with others about ideas, how to use feedback, how to manage confusion and learn from mistakes and failure, and how to take on increasing responsibility for their own learning. Students are not just given harder work, they are supported to develop the tools, habits, and confidence to do harder thinking. That distinction matters. In the name of fairness, educators sometimes remove too much cognitive friction. We over-scaffold, we pre-digest the work. We move students through tasks without helping them build the learning power that would let them do more of the work themselves. Sarita does not argue for less support. She argues for better support, and support that is designed from the beginnings to be gradually released, internalized, and owned by the learner. Welcome, Sarita. I'm so happy that you're able to join with me. I've learned so much from both listening to you and reading your important work, and you contribute so much to everybody that we're graced by having your presence.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always good to be in conversation around these topics.
It very much is. One of the themes that run through much of my work has been the social and emotional conditions that enable young people to learn, thrive, and be generative. You also touch on those things, and at the same time, you really talk about the importance of development of learning power. How do you see the relationship between learning power and these conditions?
Yeah, I actually think that they are symbiotic, right? In the sense that we have to have those learning conditions in order to put that brain into a state of alert, a relaxed alertness, they call it, right? And so again, I think the idea of relationships and cognitive work and developing students' cognitive capacity are not two silos, right? Because the brain is an integrated whole. Its ability to regulate its emotions, particularly when those emotions are close to emotion, right? Yeah. And so it's so important for the conditions to be right in terms of the student to feel psychological safety, intellectual safety, a sense of belonging, so that the brain can relax and not be on threat alert, so it actually can engage in this kind of deeper work. So I think that we're very much aligned around those two areas, right? The social emotional sense of safety and support and belonging, as well as cognitive capacity building.
As I listen to you right now, I think about the fact that one of the points I have been trying to make to people who are concerned with school climate, which is not unimportant, is there are only some aspects of climate that are proximal just at that within the moment of learning. And you've hit the nail on the head here. These are the things that are there that can create that immediate readiness. And when they do it for one person, that also affects other people around them. Even when schools do good work in those areas, we still often see persistent inequities in learning. What are the conditions that are necessary not only for students to feel that they belong, which is essential, but for them to develop the confidence, agency, and co cognitive capacity to thrive?
Yeah, I think this is so important because in my newest book, Rebuilding Students' Learning Power, Teaching for Instructional Equity and Cognitive Justice, I make the point that we need to build a bridge between the belonging part and that condition and the sense of belonging to a community of learners. It's not just belonging and cognition, those two things. It's really the bridge between the next level of belonging, and which is I am in a community of learners and I am learning the craftsmanship of learning. So when we want students to really understand how to go into deeper learning, how to develop learning transfer, those are skills. That's a craft. And we don't honor students' level of development and intelligence and agency enough to actually initiate them into that kind of cognitive apprenticeship. So I see cognitive apprenticeship is the next level of what it means to belong. I belong to the guild of learners who are here in this school to actually develop our tools and our capacities and our professional kind of lens and expertise as learners, right? So to me, that is the next level of conversation. And I don't think there's enough instructional leadership yet to create those conditions for bridging between just the social belonging. We've got that pretty down pat, but I think being able to now build this bridge to this next level up.
Can you draw a little, perhaps from your new book, but also perhaps from all the work you've done, where you have seen teachers be able to do that?
Yeah, actually, I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and I've been working all year long with a group of teachers. We just had our celebration of learning yesterday and the year-long PLC around this very work, right? And so part of what we've done over the course of the year is to take a look into their classrooms as part of our PLC, and each one of them has looked at how they can improve student learning by putting in stronger talk practices, right? What are the structures and routines? And that way, students have a sense of connection to each other, but then they also have these talk structures that help them chew on the content and get to conceptual understanding. So, this craftsmanship of learning through talking, productive struggle, through talking, not just struggling, but grappling with concepts. And so they've done their own inquiry into how do we support that? What needs to change? And the teachers literally are trying things out. And it's just really powerful because part of our presentations yesterday were what were the students saying? What were the moments that mattered? And it's just really telling in terms of students feeling a sense of safety to be vulnerable, to make mistakes and learn from them. And I talk about that in my new book, Creating a Culture of Errors. So, this is kind of part of what they did. And we talk about that instructional core, the classroom, as a dojo, right? Kind of like from martial arts. You go in and you're learning the kicks and the rolls and you're sparring with others and you're learning to be this black belt, getting the skills and capacity so that you keep growing and developing. And so they were able to see their own practice in new ways, become metacognitive about their instructional practices through the effort of getting students to be metacognitive about their own learning. So it was really a beautiful thing to see, right? And that next level of belonging was their kind of initiation into this cognitive apprenticeship.
That's wonderful. That's a level of collective cognitive belonging where, where we
That's it.
are this generative community of intellectual craftspeople.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that in my conditions for learning work, authentic challenge, which is more than rigor and more than high expectations is one of the core conditions. I kept on hearing it in the early part of this century from students who kept on talking about teachers who said they expected a lot, but there was no connection whatsoever to what they needed or what they desired. How do educators know when they're creating the types of productive struggle rather than overwhelming students or protecting them from the experiences that build their learning power?
Yeah, I think this is a great question because I think it really invites us to reframe, shift our gaze. We have a tendency to think about what teachers need to do to create the right balance versus how do we shift our gaze toward the student because only the learner learns. So, how are we coaching the student to take on the right amount of challenge, to recognize when they're in overwhelm, to have a strategy for correcting any dysregulation. So I think being able to have the teacher in partnership with the student becomes so much of an important element. And this is why that relational, that sense of belonging, that sense of connection. So now I can have a conversation because the point of overwhelm is going to be slightly different for different students. So the teacher wants to get an idea of how to regulate that, but again, how to create those conditions. But then the student has to learn how to regulate themselves, right? And so being able to know when I'm confused, know when it's too much, what's my protocol for kind of pulling back and pivoting. So being able to be in partnership, not just around the relational part, but partnership around this balance of challenge and support.
That is so important that I think part of the challenge for teachers is to be able to understand what each learner's zone of proximal development is at that moment. And no matter how gifted the teacher is, that's an impossible task for them to do alone. But if one's building the capacity of young people to both be able to do it and
That's right.
communicate it, then you again have this much more powerful learning community.
What I would add is that's actually what I try to break down in the book, right? The nuts and bolts of how to do that, because I think teachers know that's true, but how do I partner with students where I'm helping them to actually think about their learning moves, right? And so I talk about this idea of coaching students to be metacognitive about them, but also metastrategic. What needs to change? What needs to happen? So that the teacher is shifting that sense of agency to the student, right? And not shifting it like I'm holding a 50-pound weight now, here, you take it, right? But again, gradually increasing it like a personal trainer would do. You start with a little 5-pound weight. I'm going to graduate you in 6 weeks to the 15-pound weight. And that's going to feel like a little bit of struggle, but ooh, I'm going to coach and support you. And now you're going to be, work your way up to the 20. This is what we end up having to be able to create the conditions for. But it means that student is really aware that they are going to go into the learning pit. There's going to be a little struggle. I'm going to have, be a little wobbly. And the wobble is the point. That is when the brain responds with growth. So being able to create that condition where they're in relationship is what I really try to break down. How do we use habits? So the student now is creating a habit recipe around what I want to do different when I encounter confusion, what I want to do different. Because if it always rests with the teacher, the student doesn't walk away with new things. Oh, the teacher will help me get out of confusion. Oh, the teacher will help me do that. So just being able to understand how the teacher coaches this student is what I really am trying to help the teacher develop, right? That capacity to do that work versus I got to do it all. No, only the learner learns. We're coaching them so that they can grow this skill for themselves as well.
When students were talking yesterday during the session, were they talking about how they experienced that, how that felt for them, what it meant?
So we had, it was just teachers
Oh, I'm sorry.
yesterday, but in our session, but all teachers were either, oh, that's okay, but they videotape and audio tape so that their quotes were directly from what the students said.
Okay.
And what the students were saying is they felt Their confidence was up because they can start making deeper connections. So this is back to your point about deeper learning. So before, where they were just confused and didn't see how big concepts, one teacher was talking about apartheid, the middle school social studies teacher, authoritarianism, some other really big concepts for the kids. And they weren't always able to make the connections. But when she was starting to bring in the craftsmanship of learning and some of the tools surrounding that, their reflection is, ah, now I was more confident because I had some tools about how I can make connections. I'm starting to see the deeper architecture here. So their understanding of what's shifting for them was really clear. So it becomes important for the student to be able to articulate that. And sometimes we don't give the space to that. And I think that is part of the balance we need to bring in, right? If we want challenge, we have to give space for that kind of work, right? Just like the dojo, it has to have space if you want people to be doing moves and rolls and sparring. You're going to have padding. This is back to the conditions, right? You can't have everybody just sitting in the row being quiet and orderly. That's going to lead to compliance versus the kind of productive struggle and grappling that we need to have as part of this kind of challenge support balance.
Let me move on to something else that I know you have written so powerfully about in your first book, and also in, among other things, a commentary that you did in The Science of Learning and Development, which highlights the role of relationships, identity, context, and meaning making. You've written extensively about culture as a cognitive force. What does culture add to our understanding of how students learn and thrive?
Yeah, I think this is a really important thing for teachers, leaders who are really bringing in the science of learning and development into kind of their conversations, their instructional leadership, into teacher practice in ways that are beyond kind of the brain-based strategies, right? The superficial ways that they do it. And I think culture becomes a thing that needs to be reframed because we think of it as either a euphemism for talking about race, or we think about it as a way to affirm students by making the content culturally congruent or reflective of the student body. I think the part that people miss in terms of culture is understanding that culture is just schema. It's the way we organize information in our head. Now, the first law of the principle, I call it a law, right? The first law of learning is all new learning must be coupled with existing learning, existing knowledge and background information that the student has, or that whoever the learner is, even for us as adults, it's still true. So when we understand culture as schema, this is the way students have organized information in their head, then we know we need to be able to tap it, activate it, connect to it cognitively if we want them to take in and process new information. So it's another way to get people to understand that whatever students are bringing to the classroom is valuable because it has to be part of the recipe for students turning inert information into usable knowledge, right? Usable information. So, yeah, I think this is a piece that we can continue to help leaders and teachers and coaches understand culture as schema as it sits within the science of learning.
For years, you've argued that engagement is not the same as learning. How can we tell the difference? And how can we get both in ways that are mutually synergistic?
Yeah, and I think I push on this idea of engagement is not the same as learning because of the way people have defined engagement, right? And they're usually defining engagement as observable activity among students. They walk into a classroom, it's not just the teacher talking and students sitting passively, that, oh, students are engaged because they are talking and chatting with their peers and folks are moving around and kids are doing things with their hands. And we say, oh, look, those students are engaged. But we also understand that kind of activity doesn't always mean students are learning, right? Dr. Robert Coe talked about this idea of poor proxies. Busyness is often a poor proxy proxy for learning. Just because you were busy didn't mean you learned it. And so understanding that we can reframe engagement in terms of its original place in the science of learning, which is the brain has to get engage. It has to start its information processing cycle. Curiosity starts that information processing cycle. Relevance, novelty. There are a lot of things that will engage or ignite the brain so that the information processing flywheel starts to churn for the student in a positive way. So yes, we don't learn if it's just passive and it's just dry and it's just drill and kill. It has to have this igniting element. And igniting really does mean some type of engagement, but all engagement is not equal. And that, I think, is the piece that I have been trying to help people understand, right? And this is why you have to know your students. This is back to your point about relationship. If you don't know what ignites them, if you don't know what connections they're making or what they're curious is about. How do you create that kind of positive tension in their brain that makes them want to lean in and figure something out? That's engagement. Have you engaged the brain to now actually say, I can't stop thinking about that, or I want to fix this? So that now you don't have to do much to get them to actually continue with the lesson, particularly the hard parts, right? Because if all we're doing is making it fun, students are going to tap out when it gets hard. And we want them to actually be able to lean into the hard part. This is where curiosity does much more than just plain old entertainment type of engagement.
You have just so eloquently unpacked what I mean by academic challenge, because it's when those things are happening that we can really talk about a young person being challenged or an adult being challenged. It's not just
That's right.
behaviors.
That's right.
One thing that is important to not only igniting, but to enable the fire to burn that you've talked a great deal about and written about is psychological safety, intellectual safety, feeling that you can really be intellectually generative. I'm adding my language right now. Can you talk about that and its importance?
Yeah, I think it is another one of those essential elements, right? So we do need a sense of belonging and connection. We need that relationship. Students need to know that there's going to be support. But one of the, I think, invisible factors is this idea of intellectual safety and what that means, because I do think we often confuse it with the psychological safety. Psychological safety is more social. Like, I know I'm accepted. I get along with these people. They're not laughing at me. We all are engaged in wanting to have that psychological safety. But you can have psychological safety, but not intellectual safety, particularly in our school environments where learning is getting the right answer fast. So now, if I'm a slow processor or I need some talking to process, then I may not be the quickest. So it feels intellectually safe to quickly answer and be wrong because now I'm up against all the hands that go are the first to go up. So psychological safety can be there, but intellectual safety has to be cultivated. And this is what I mean by creating a culture of errors where the teacher is explicit. In this classroom, errors are information and we use them. That statement is backed up with processes and protocols where we study our errors individually and collectively, not just to correct our work, but to learn. Oh, what were we thinking when we made this turn? And so now students actually have language to talk about this. Now, what's interesting is when we think about musicians or craftspeople, they do this all the time. They talk about it as critique.
Right.
How do they get feedback? How do they talk about what's right about something? And nobody gets upset. They just know it's part of that. And I actually need that feedback. So if we understand errors as feedback, then there has to be a classroom in which it's intellectually safe for me to make mistakes publicly. That's what public learning looks like. So when we want students to be doing this collaborative work, we have to have created that condition. So I do think it's so important because, again, students can't get to the deeper level, they can get to surface learning, but to get to the deeper level is going to require mistakes, right? And it's going to require the prototyping. I call it you go through the first pancake, right? You do the first prototype, it's just not going to be perfect. And so you study it and you talk with your peers about it. And so being able to have that environment becomes so important.
How did teachers model that? Just not only enable it, but how do they model it in the classroom?
It's funny because in the new book, I actually have a rollout plan, right? It's okay. Over 4 weeks, here's what you're going to do. One of the first things we do is I have them write a script. Like, how will you say that? Because you're just making a statement. Students are like, and particularly by middle school, they've been conditioned by years of schooling that have said it's all about the right answer, it's all about speed, it's all about this is what smart looks like. And so you just with one little statement at the beginning of the school year is not going to be enough to counter that conditioning. So we really talk about it as creating a plan so that over 4 weeks you're cultivating this new mindset. You're putting in protocols and practices. So one of the ways to do that is how are you studying your mistakes? A protocol I give them to share with students is what's the muddiest point? So at some point in the learning, we stop to actually just share our confusions. It's not about trying to correct them. Yeah, this part I didn't understand. I understood up until this point. So it's like, what was the muddiest point? To normalize talking about mistakes in a way that's not just you made a mistake, oh, now we're going to put it in front. And then we have norms that they create with students around how we talk about mistakes or how we treat others emotionally around mistakes. We don't laugh at each other. This is part of the culture setting for the cognitive apprenticeship that has to go alongside the culture setting for the social part of the classroom. This becomes so important, particularly at third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, when kids start needling each other, they're developing their identities as learners, right? Who's smart, who's not? It's so important to be explicit. So those are just a few things that I have them do over that 4 to 6 weeks to really set those conditions. But I make it explicit. Like it's not going to just happen because you've made a statement. You are going to have to actually create these conditions.
Great. A central theme in your work is helping students move from being dependent learners to being self-directed, and I'll add metacognitive learners. What are the most important shifts teachers can make to support that transition?
Yes, I think that one of the most important things are for teachers to become metacognitive about their practice, and particularly around scaffolding, right? What is the right amount of scaffolding? Because there is a way in which, right now, under the guise of equity of access, we are over scaffolding for students, and we're taking the cognitive friction out of the work, right? Cognitive friction is required. That is what we mean by grappling or productive struggle. But what I've seen is teachers scaffolding to the point where they're moving students through the lesson, but the student doesn't have everything's pre-digested. The student really doesn't have to do any deep thinking. They can just answer some questions. And even if they've moved beyond worksheets, it's still not the kind of deep thinking that we need, right? And so one of the major shifts that we talk about is this idea of assessing your own amount of scaffolding. And we need the right amount, but everything needs to be transitioned out. So what's your plan for the gradual release of responsibility? The minute you put a scaffold in place, you have to have a plan for the transition, for the release of that. So the way I coach teachers is, when you give, let's say it's a sentence frame, because we love the sentence frames these days. When you give that student a sentence frame, you also tell them, in 6 weeks, we're going to phase this out. I'm going to take it, and if you have it on the walls, it's on a poster, you've given them a worksheet, and you tell them these three things that I've given as a support, every 2 weeks, we're going to phase one out. And you have to internalize it. So they have to check for internalization, not just check for understanding. Do you understand what you should be doing? So that the teacher has an explicit plan and that the student doesn't become dependent on the teacher. So that's one of the major shifts that I see. Again, who's doing the talking? How do you actually make sure that students have time to talk? And it's more robust than a turn and talk, right? A think, pair, share, right? The problem with the think, pair, share is right there in the title. All you're doing is sharing. Here's what I think. Here's what I think. And now there's no real grappling. Nobody's grappling with anything. That's over in 30 seconds, right? And the students are on to talk about what's happening on TikTok. So the reality is there are a few things that teachers need to do, but I do think making sure their talk structures, students have talk routines, but also teachers really monitoring the kind of scaffolding they're putting in place. They're not rescuing students when they're confused. They're not doing too much front loading, those sorts of things.
There's a river.